Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. My younger brother and I grew up amid walls covered with artwork, mostly oil paintings in an abstract style, and virtually all of it painted and framed by our dad, who did it as a hobby, though he said he had taken lessons in his youth at the Art Institute of Chicago. Maybe being surrounded by paintings and the trips we took as a family to the Art Institute is one reason I feel so comfortable in art museums, including the excellent Hillstrom Museum on the Gustavus campus. Joining me today is Donald Myers, director of the Hillstrom, a position he has held for the last 20 years. An alumnus of Gustavus, Don graduated magna cum laude in 1983 with majors in art history and accounting and a minor in studio art. He earned an MA in Art History and Museum Studies from the University of Southern California and is currently working on his PhD degree from the University of Maryland. Before returning to his alma mater, Don held curatorial positions in the Department of Sculpture and Decorative Arts at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. An active scholar, he has numerous publications to his name, including essays and exhibition catalogs for the Hillstrom Museum. He also teaches art history courses as a member of the Department of Art and Art History at Gustavus. In this awful pandemic moment, when art museums and other art venues around the globe face considerable financial pressures, and it also seems more essential than ever, I wanted to speak with Don about his career and the Hillstrom, and it's great to have him on the podcast. So welcome, Don.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you so much for having me. I'm pleased to be here with you.
It's great to have you. I wish we could be together in the Hillstrom. And you're there now, I think you said right before we started recording, right? You're in your office there?
I am. That's correct.
Yeah. So how is Hillstrom being affected by COVID? Tell us.
Well, it's very quiet here, and we are open, but very limited in who can come at this point. And of course, that's very frustrating for us. Starting in the fall semester, we were on the college's code orange, which meant that anyone on campus could come to the museum, but the general public needed to ask for an invitation. And that, you know, that was okay, but it meant that we had far fewer people coming in. And right now we're still in the lay low period. So basically only students and on-campus people with an academic need to come are technically allowed. So it's very quiet here. And of course that's incredibly frustrating because we're all about presentation.
Right.
The reason why a museum exists is because it wants to present artworks and preserve those artworks. And if you can't show the artworks to people, you know, you're just not doing it. We have developed a number of sort of initiatives to try to expand our online presence. But, you know, nothing's ever as good as actually seeing the artworks in person.
Right. Yeah, well, that's true. Boy, I'm just thinking about times when I, you know, I'd had art history courses and then saw the actual painting right in person. What a difference. You just made a really important point, though. I mean, in a way, it's obvious, but I hadn't really thought about that. Just how, in a way, how cruel this pandemic is to museums, right? I mean, the whole point is to be engaged with the public.
Right. And
there you are, right? So yeah, it's not just the financial, it's the you know, the whole mission, right? Is
exactly the mission. I mean, we're all very passionate about I think of museum people as just loving the things that they're in charge of, that they work with, and wanting to, you know, convey that to others. And if you can't show them, how can you do that?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I agree. I mean, the online, it's helpful. I've done a little bit, you know, like with the Minnesota Orchestra here and and also the Metropolitan Museum of Art, but still not the same. Better than nothing, but not the same. Yeah. We can come back to that and what exhibits are there in a bit. Let's circle back in time to your own background. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up how you came to Gustavus as a student.
Well, I am from southern Minnesota, small town called Ceylon, Minnesota.
Oh, I don't know where that is. Where is that?
It's close to Fairmont, and it's right on the Iowa border. And I suppose its main claim to fame is that it's where the Mondales lived when Fritz Mondale was born.
Oh.
In town. And So Gustavus wasn't too far away, and I had some teachers, probably most notably my music teacher, who had gone to Gustavus and, you know, spoke about how strong a program it was in whatever you wanted to take. So it was kind of always in the background of my mind. And really, it's the only school that I applied to when I was ready to go off to college. It's funny, I was thinking about this. When I first started at Gustavus, I thought I might be a physics major. And that did not happen. In fact, I didn't take any physics classes at all. It's kind of a point of irony with our family because my son is also a Gusty. He graduated in 2019, and he was a physics major and is in physics graduate studies. So.
That's terrific. That's funny.
Yeah. My wife and I both are class of 1983. So we're you know, very strong lovers of Gustavus. I'm not what you call a perma-Gusty. I didn't stay here, you know, the whole time after graduation. We were away from Minnesota for a number of years, a decade and a half or so.
Right.
You were going to say something?
Oh no, I'm just thinking. That's right. There's the perma-Gusty who comes to say and graduates and stays, and then there are the people like the Gusties like you who head off for a bit and sometimes come back. I'm just curious. So what is your wife's name?
Joni.
Joni. Did you and Joni meet at Gustavus? Or
we did. Yes, we we actually met at a party in one of the dorms. Yeah. But I remembered that, but she didn't. And we got to know each other in Bruce McLean's painting class. She was a studio art major.
That's great. So that's wonderful. Yeah, Bruce McLean, one of the profs. I want to come back and maybe talk a bit about him, some of your teachers. But so was there my dad did not go to college, as regular listeners know. My mom went to a 2-year teacher's college. Had your parents gone to college, or are you a first generation?
No, my father took a couple courses. They were both from Ames, Iowa, so at the University of Iowa, or excuse me, Iowa State University. But no, neither of them were college grads. But I have an older brother who had gone through and had done some graduate studies, so it was kind of the norm to expect that, yeah, maybe you will go to college.
Right.
It wasn't a surprise or anything.
Yeah. I'm same here. I think about that a lot. I wish I could. My parents are deceased. Wish I could talk to them about that. Both my parents, but my dad was always so encouraging. Even when I was struggling to complete my PhD, he was still supportive in more ways than one. That's not always the case with people who themselves haven't gone to college. What about the attraction to art history? It sounds like, so you came thinking you would major in physics. How did you wind up in art history?
Well, I was also interested in accounting, but also art, studio art. And for quite a while, I was a studio art major. The only thing that I lacked was a life drawing class and then the senior show. But I took Linnea Wren's art history class. I knew that I would like it. I just didn't know how much I would like it. So after Art 101, I thought, oh, this is fantastic. I love this. And at that time, the art history major was what they called a distributed major. You sort of cobbled it together with your advisor's assistants, and you had classes from not only the art department, but, for instance, classics and can't remember where else, but it was something that I had to definitely reach out to do. And I was very pleased how it turned out. I thought Linnea Wren was a fantastic professor.
Yes. Yeah, Linnea, I actually would like to record with her, now retired. But when I came, to me, she was one of the greats on the faculty. I'd loved art history as an undergraduate, and I have such strong memories of Linnea. Seeing Linnea, I'm a new faculty member. In the library, I would go to the library to finish my dissertation or try to finish it. And there would be Linnea in the summer, right, working, doing research. And I found that very inspiring. And and I wondered if you had one. I didn't know. I wondered if you had studied with her, because she has taught. I mean, she taught over her career. I mean, just so many wonderful students who've gone on to do some amazing things, including you. And so with studio art, Bruce McLean was there, whose paintings I love. Was he there? It sounds like you said.
Oh, yeah, he definitely was. And he was certainly very encouraging. He also taught art history. He taught the contemporary art history class, and that was another influence for me. So I think the world of Bruce and of him as an artist, too. We've done two exhibits of his work here at the Hillster Museum.
Yes, and, which I love.
He's a fantastic painter.
Yeah. I've got a thing about airplanes I've had since a kid. So all that art that he does relate, I just love, including that exhibit at the Hillstrom. What about, I'm trying to think who else, Don Palmgren, was he there?
He was, yeah. Don was my wife's and my instructors both. And he was very encouraging. I think that Joni was particularly close to him. We had a big exhibit not too long after he retired, and his works are also really quite wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, just some terrific artists. And then, of course, and Paul Granlund, the sculptor, was he already there as well?
Yeah, he was. He was in the point where he wasn't doing much teaching anymore, but he was definitely a presence. And I didn't really know him very well. It wasn't until later that when we did the exhibit in 2003, a retrospective of his career, that we got to know each other, you know, very well. I ran into him at the National Gallery of Art, and I recognized him. He didn't recognize me, and that was kind of a fun encounter.
Yeah, I had I didn't know much about him. I knew of his work through a friend who I somehow a friend who someone in her family had gone to college with Paul, but so I was aware of his work before coming to Gustavus, and of course had seen it. I mean, it's all over the place. But that was kind of cool to know he was there. Let's I'm thinking about your own experience in studio art. Was it painting you were drawn to, or drawing, or sculpting? What were you doing?
No, it was definitely painting, and I still love the smell of oil paint particularly. And I have the idea that someday, maybe when I retire, I will kind of return to it. I'm not claiming to be a great artist, but I just always enjoyed it. And one of my proudest moments was Don Gregory was another faculty member at Gustavus, and he was close to being retired at the time that I was a student here, but he was teaching a little bit, and he was on campus, and we were doing self-portraits in Bruce McLean's class, and there was some kind of art department gathering, and Don Gregory told me that he really liked my self-portrait. Boy, was I in heaven when I heard that.
On cloud nine, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned about the smell of oil paints. I smell it right now, thinking about our conversation, because I can smell. My dad was a hairdresser, and as I said, didn't go to college. He said he, did some studying at the Art Institute. I've never verified that, but in any case, he grew up in Chicago, and he would sometime. He owned his own salons often, and he would announce. My brother and I worked in the salons as sort of cleanup boys, but he would announce to us, boys, I'm having a painting fit. I can still hear him saying, and he would off we would go to the art supply store, which I also love. He'd buy stuff, and then he would just go to the garage. This is in suburban Park Forest, south suburb of Chicago. Just paint. And paint like mad, like a madman, it seemed to me. But sometimes on wood, often on canvas, and then he would frame them. He'd frame them wet, too. I mean, he just did it all. Anyway, but that smell brings back a lot of fond memories. And then,
absolutely.
Unlike you, I never studied. I think I took a couple of art courses maybe in high school. But my brother and I and a good friend still, we sort of played. We liked to play. We were Van Gogh or Gauguin, our impressionists. Just slap on oil paint on canvas. But, that's not painting. Anyway, so you also you majored in accounting. Is that something that came before the art history or with it or after? How did
that Well, that was something that was kind of in my mind when I started. Another of my teachers in Ceylon had been a Gustavus grad, and he was the bookkeeping teacher. And it just seemed like, well, this is something that I could possibly do. And so I did a double major. And right after graduating from Gustavus, I actually worked for a year as an auditor for a certified public accounting firm in Minneapolis, Adrian Helgeson and Company. At that time, they were doing all the audits for the Lutheran colleges. So I actually worked on the St. Olaf audit in that year.
Wow.
And it's interesting to me, there's a tendency of people to think of art people as being, maybe not well-grounded, flaky perhaps. And I have found that when I tell people that I also have an accounting major, it sort of changes their opinion.
Yes.
Like, oh, okay.
Yeah, right. You're not just some, you know, flaky. I know exactly what you mean. And I would think that has served you well, too, certainly in your current position.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's just sort of a mindset, being able to deal with numbers. And that's always come pretty naturally to me. So I don't feel like I have difficulties with budgets, for instance.
Yeah, no, I'm also imagining you have a lot of dirt on all the Lutheran colleges as an audience. that's ancient history and maybe another podcast.
Things have all changed by now.
I'm sure. So, you know, I think I love the National Gallery, and many listeners, if not all listeners, I'm sure have been there. And how did you land that gig? I mean, that must have been incredible.
Oh, it was a wonderful experience. After a year of working as an auditor, I went on to the program in art history/museum studies at the University of Southern California. I had applied for that and gotten a really nice package, and then deferred when I got the job. Part of that program, it was the same amount of art history as their master's program, but it also been added to that. A museum studies class, a two-semester museum studies class, which was the basis of my own museum studies class here at Gustavus. And then there was a third year that was an internship at a museum. And I was able to arrange an internship in the National Gallery of Art Sculpture Department. The program was heavily supported by the very wealthy Getty Museum at that time. And so we actually were given a living stipend, which made it possible for my wife and me to move out to D.C. So I did my 9-month internship and then was immediately hired on in the department after that was over. And that was just a fantastic experience, you know, being in a place like that every day, being able to, lunch break, and I'm going to go look at Jan van Eyck, just simply mouth-wateringly gorgeous painting. It's just amazing.
That's so cool. Just a couple of summers ago, I was there for a National Endowment for the Humanities in D.C., National Endowment for the Humanities Summer Institute. And a bunch of us took time to find, I had never been, believe it or not, to the Portrait Gallery. And my God, that was just, wow. Amazing. Yeah. I love that. I love D.C.
Oh, it's wonderful for museums.
Yeah.
And you get sort of spoiled because they're, pretty much all of them are free.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's right. Which reminds me, my dad I was always embarrassed. My dad would say, you don't have to pay to go to the Art Institute, at least at that time. I'd say, no, Dad, that's not true. And he was right. You could, you know, it just was a donation. So I remember once he, proving the point to me, left a quarter as we went in, you know. But anyway, that's a whole other story, right? Getting museum.
Yeah, but, you know, I think that most museum people would rather that people come in that way than hold back because they don't have whatever the sort of going rate is.
Sure.
I know that's how I feel.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And the Hillstrom is free, right?
And it's open, absolutely. Yeah.
Open to anybody.
You know, that's pretty standard for a college or university museum, but the Minneapolis Institute of Art is free too. And,
right.
And I think that's a good thing.
Fabulous museum. And just wife and I, Kate and I live downtown, not that far from downtown Minneapolis. It's a great museum. So from there, I mean, with that incredible experience, now you're doing some teaching and lecturing as well and writing, of course. But from there, you returned to Gustavus. Was it in 2000? You returned to Gustavus to take up the current position as director of the Hillstrom. Why don't we talk a little bit, or have you talk a little bit about the Hillstrom, its founding, its mission, and why you decided to come back?
Sure. Well, as I said earlier, my wife and I both were and are very fond of Gustavus. And so the idea of maybe being able to come here and be involved with it, beyond being a student, was very appealing. And actually, I came a little earlier. It was a sabbatical replacement for Linnea Wren in, I think it was the fall of 1998 and J-term of 1999. And so I came back and took, a leave from the National Gallery and taught here. And then a little bit later, they created a new teaching position, which I started in early 2000. But already at that time, this is past the tornado and, And somebody had the idea that we could create a museum in the north end of the campus center. So that was in the works. And I heard about it, and I think people thought that perhaps that might be something of interest to me, that I might be a good fit, et cetera, et cetera. So that was kind of in my mind already. And then early in 2000, that's when I was appointed to be the director of the museum. Technically, I'm the director and the senior curator. But, okay. You know, those things all kind of are meaningless when you just have me and my assistant, Colleen Hansen. We kind of do everything. I'm also the registrar. I'm also the preparator.
Yeah, you do everything. It's true. So we say the Hillstrom, right? And I often just call it Hillstrom. But tell us a little bit about Hillstrom, who he is, was.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, Reverend Richard L. Hillstrom. He was a Gustavus grad of 1938. And I think it's entirely appropriate that the museum is named after him. Our own collection, which now numbers close to 600 works, is based on his collection. And so he donated, you know, many artworks to the museum during his lifetime and then also in his will. He was also an incredible monetary supporter. We have an endowment that allows us to acquire a few works of art and cover some other expenses as well. And Reverend Hillstrom was the primary donor to that. I well remember in 2012 getting a call from Rick and him saying, I'm going to be sending you a check for the endowment for $1 million. Okay, that's fantastic.
Those are numbers I can understand, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, we're named after Rick Hillstrom. Before I came to campus, it was recognized that maybe if the college could create, a venue of this sort, that Rick would be interested in giving the college his collection. He had already given a handful of artworks. And basically, you know, if you build it, they'll come. That's what happened. We built the museum. And when we first opened, Rick showed me a list of his collection, a list of the works still in his holding, because he had donated to many different institutions across Minnesota. The Walker, the Minneapolis Institute of Art, the Weissman, et cetera. And that list, the 70 works on the bottom of it, you know, think of it as a list that's prioritized by most important works at the top and least important works at the bottom. The 70 of them at the bottom were designated to come to Gustavus. Hmm. And the rest were going to go to the Minneapolis Institute of Art. And so, of course, you know what my goal was. Hmm. Let's get all those to come here. And it was almost successful. There were a few works that Rick still gave to the MIA, and you know, I don't begrudge that in any way. I often feel kind of bad. I know that they must have thought that they'd be getting all its collection. They did a big exhibit of his collection in 1993, I think it was. Huh. And I'm sure all those works at that time would have been going to them if it hadn't been that the Hillstrom Museum of Art was opened.
Well, you can, I don't know, maybe you can loan them some or something. I never met him. I heard so much about it. I just think it's cool. For some reason, I think it's really neat that a man who's a minister, right, is also this incredible art collector. Do you have any idea how he got started in collecting?
Yeah, I do. It was a story that he liked to tell. He did not study art at Gustavus. Basically, there wasn't art to study in his day. And he didn't grow up in a, you know, like your background with a father who did paintings. There were a few pictures on the walls of their home. He was from Dassel, Minnesota, not terribly far from here. But when he went to seminary and started being a Lutheran minister, he became friends with another minister who had some paintings by some Swedish American artists. And it's like a light bulb went off. He suddenly thought, you know, I could do that too. And he started collecting these paintings by people like Birger Sandzain. And it just, you know, sort of snowballed from there. Initially collected artists who were Swedish Americans. Then he comes back to Minnesota and he is very active in collecting important Minnesota artists like Cameron Booth or Clement Halpers. Excuse me. And then he went on a cruise and started reading about the great American Impressionist artist John Twachtman. And he thought, you know, I'm going to expand to not just be regional artists, but important American artists nationally. And that's when he started collecting Ashcan School artists, the so-called eight, and regionalist works and that sort of thing. It became sort of the core of his collecting. I always describe it as being American art of the first half of the 20th century, mostly in the figurative tradition.
Okay. I love the, you know, I have a big smile on my face when you said Ashcan, because that's some of my favorite art. And I love that part of the collection. It's just a great story. It's fantastic. So, some of that, I suppose, some of what you're talking about, you're working to acquire all and getting most of his collection is what, is that typically what a director of a museum is involved in?
Oh yeah, absolutely. If you're an acquiring museum, you're keeping your eyes open for ways to acquire, and obviously the best way is to get people to give you things.
Sure.
And Rick was extremely generous in that way. We have some fantastic works. I have to tell you a story. Rick always described his George Bellos painting as the cream of the crop of his collection. George Bellos is really recognized as one of the most important American artists of the first half of the 20th century. And just by example, when the National Gallery in London acquired its first work by an American artist, it was a George Bellos painting. So one day I was visiting Rick and he said, I want you to sit down. And he said he had decided that he thought he should give the Bellos to the Minneapolis Institute of Art. And I'm sure that I probably totally blanched and sputtered. And, you know, I didn't have much to say then, but I went home and the next day I was ready to call him and just, you know, sort of lay out why it would be better to give it to us because it would be, you know, part of his overall collection. And I barely got started on my plea. And he said, well, never mind, because I've changed my mind.
That's great. You know, you're reminding me, my wife, Kate's, mom, she, and I guess her dad too, to some extent, but she wasn't, I wouldn't say a collector, but she, you know, she acquired antiques and things. And Kate and I have a Bellows that she has, and I'm trying to think, it's in our, I think it's, could it be a, I should run and go look at it, but it's a sketch, right? It's sort of dark. I should bring that in and show you sometime.
I'd love to see it. Yeah, you can just even take a photo and show.
Oh yeah, I'll do that. Sure, I'll do that too. Yeah,
Bellos was a real favorite of Reverend Hillstrom. With many of the artists, most of the artists that he collected, he would get one work and then he'd go on to another artist. But with Bellos, he has the oil painting, which is the cream of the crop, and quite a few drawings and four of Bellos's lithographs.
Wow. That's so great. The so being a curator or being a director of a place like the Hillstrom means acquiring. And what else are you? What else are your what other responsibilities are yours as director?
Well, obviously, the
short answer is everything. I know.
Well, yeah, everything. But I mean, our exhibitions program, I think, is the most visible thing that I do. We have an active exhibitions program. Usually in an academic year, we'll show somewhere between 4 and 8 different exhibits, often, you know, running contemporaneously. We always will cap off our year with the annual senior show. But we do a wide variety of exhibitions and planning that and figure out what's possible, because we do exhibits based on what we have here, but we also borrow exhibits. Sometimes there are ones that are organized, like the two current exhibits of works by Arthur Bowen Davies. Those were organized by the Meyer Museum of Art at Randolph College in Lynchburg, Virginia. And so we borrowed the exhibit from them. But we'll also put together our own exhibits. You mentioned Elmir de Hori, the show that we had last spring that unfortunately closed down because of the onslaught of the pandemic. That was portraits by Elmir de Hori. And it was a wonderful show and just so sad to not be able to keep it open. especially after the New York Times had an article that covered
it. Yes, we saw that. We're avid readers of the Times. Tell us, I was hoping, you know, we would get to talk about that. I wanted to see. So tell us a little bit about Dehori, who he was. And that was a great show, great story.
Well, we actually had two exhibits of his work back in 2010. We did our first one. And he was one of the most notorious art forgers in U.S. history. And Mark Forgy met him as a young man who was doing a backpacking trip across Europe. And he happened to go to Ibiza and met this dapper gentleman who became his friend. And eventually Mark became his assistant. And at the time, Mark didn't know that there was this story exploding about Elmer as this incredible art faker. But it came to light soon after when Clifford Irving wrote a book about Elmer Dehori. And of course, Clifford Irving, right after that, he wrote his fake,
right,
his biography of Howard Hughes.
Exactly.
And then the story was also told in a movie by none other than Orson Welles. And you can see Mark Forgy in the Orson Welles film. But Mark became the heir to Elmer Dehori, and so has this wonderful cache of works by Elmer. And those were the basis of the two exhibits that we had. And just a fascinating story. Elmer was, he held himself out as being a Hungarian, you know, aristocrat falling on hard times because of the war. And it was a lot of spinning of tails, really. But he did get to know a lot of high society people. He's close friends with Ursula Andress. Supposedly he made a portrait of Zsa Zsa Gabor that she didn't like and wouldn't pay for. But just a fascinating, fascinating story. And Mark actually wrote a sort of memoir of his time with Elmer. It's called the Forger's Apprentice. And he gave lecture at the time of our first exhibit based on his connection with Elmer. And then he was going to give another lecture when the second exhibit last year occurred, but of course everything had to be canceled.
Yeah, that is a shame. But it was absolutely fascinating. Mark didn't go to Gustavus, did he?
No, he was a student from Hopkins, and then just decided to go tour Europe. I think partly because of wanting to avoid going to Vietnam.
Yeah,
and you know, not too many years later, when Elmer Dehori died, he took his own life. Mark was the heir, and so he comes back to Minnesota and just kind of, you know, sits with his story and his objects. And I met him through a faculty member, Stan Shetka.
Oh, sure.
And visited Mark. He was living in the Twin Cities at that time, and saw the works and thought, God, this is a fantastic story. And of course, I'm thinking we want to do an exhibit, which is what we did.
The you know, there's so many questions I want to ask about this. I don't have time for all of them, but one is, so once you know, once a forger is found out, right, as Dehori was, what, I mean, then what is the value of what the person has forged?
Well, it depends on the forger. And Elmer was somebody who wanted to be recognized as a fine artist on his own. So once he was identified, he did a lot of works in his own style, or works that he signed with his own name in the style of other people like Henri Matisse or Modigliani. And he also was always doing these portraits of people in sort of society, cafe life in Ibiza. And they're very immediate. He was a very accomplished draftsman. But because of the notoriety of him, his works, whether they're in his own hand or especially if they're works purporting to be by other artists, they can be really quite valuable. And in fact, there's a very active market, especially on eBay, of fake Elmer fakes.
Oh my God.
And Mark Forgy is, you know, carefully policing that as much as he can. But, you know, you see things that are this is Elmer Dehori. It's like, it's not at all.
It's a fake. Oh, that's amazing. So it's, I don't know. We talk about deep fake and the internet. Wow. That's incredible. Somehow this all relates to fake news, I suppose. We'll figure it out. But, oh, wow. That's fascinating. Yeah, that was. So do you think, I mean, would there be plans to remount that exhibit that had to close because of COVID? Or?
No, I don't think that that's really a thing that we would do. You know, we're always moving forward, looking to the next thing. And we typically have our exhibitions planned at least a couple years in advance. And, you know, the exhibit did go through about half of its time. We have a catalog. The catalog's on our website. I wish we had been able to do, we started now doing what I call walkthrough video tours.
Right.
We have a videographer just kind of do a straight line through the exhibit and do an image of every work. And then we superimpose the title, date, and medium, et cetera. I wish we had been able to do that. But we did do some work with the Fine Arts Office. And for a while, I think four weeks in a row, we were doing Museum Mondays. And there were images put up on the Facebook page and I think other social media sites as well with certain descriptions. And that gave a taste of what the installation looked like as well as focusing on particular works.
Right. And these videos that you're doing, right? Are you in the videos, the walkthroughs, and are they're available on the website of the museum website?
Right. They are on the website. Actually the college has the Gustavus grad, Will Clark, who's been doing the.
Oh, Will, who does the podcast with Will is our technical guru for this podcast.
Okay, wonderful. Well, he's also a great videographer, and we've been very pleased to be able to do this. My hope is that we can continue doing this really for any exhibit that it's possible. So for our next exhibit, I'm posing the question to the artist, are you willing to do this?
Yes. And,
whenever I can, I want to be able to make that available because not everybody can get to St. Peter.
Right.
You always worry that people are going to do that instead of coming to the museum. I don't think it really is going to come to that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm thinking here because, first of all, the larger question is just the whole, you know, what will be some of the lasting effects of this pandemic on work, on museums? And, you know, for example, how what you just said, right, that, you know, you're only doing this because of COVID, but maybe it's something, you know, worth continuing afterwards. Yeah, be interesting to see. I know other museums, you know more about that than I do, are considering the same. The exhibitions that you have planned, I'd like to talk just a little bit about those in a second. But before that, are there aside from Dehori, are there past exhibitions that really have, I know this is, you know, a ridiculous, impossible question, but that have really been favorites of yours at the Hill
Street? Yeah, absolutely. I was looking back over the chronological list and, you know, each year I'd look and think, oh, yeah, we did that. one of the top that comes to mind is in 2012 as part of the celebration of the sesquicentennial of the college, we did an exhibit called 150 Years of Swedish Art, Highlights from the Swedish National Collections. And we borrowed a total of about 50 artworks ranging in dates basically from when Gustavus was founded in 1862 until the current time. Those were from the National Gallery in Stockholm and the Museum of Modern Art in Stockholm. And it was fantastic to be able to bring those works here to put together this display of really, you know, remarkable masterpieces. There was a work by August Strindberg, for instance. And from these fantastic collections in Stockholm, one of my favorite stories about it is there's a well-known depiction of the death of King Gustavus Adolphus on the battlefield in Lützen. And if you go to the National Gallery in Stockholm, you know, you go up the stairs, this grand staircase, and it's there at the top of the stairs. And we were able to borrow that painting. I actually did the cataloging of it myself because I loved it so much. And I was told that a visitor from Sweden came to see the exhibit and walked in the door and mouth dropped open and said, "What's that doing here?" You know, in a way, it's insulting, but also it's like, yeah.
Exactly. Right. That's funny. There's a catalog for that, you said, right?
There is. Yeah, yeah. It's actually a very beautiful catalog. We had wonderful support in putting on this by Oke Bonier, who was part of the board at that time. And we were able to produce a lovely, beautiful hardcover catalog. And they're certainly available. The exhibit was visited by the King and Queen of Sweden.
Right. I remember that. Yeah.
That was very exciting to give them a little bit of an introduction to the exhibit.
Yeah. I remember
just where you could have traveled it elsewhere.
Well, I'm just quick aside here. I've always wondered, these paintings you're borrowing, they're just, what are they, shipped by airplane, I assume? You just, people, they're heavily insured. I mean, so.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are crates that are created for the artworks, and the crate works. The crates are basically artworks themselves. Huh. They can be really incredibly beautifully done and you know, very, very protective. But this was, you know, an undertaking that was beyond what we're usually capable of doing. And we actually hired a separate registrar to help with that process. And there was a lot of negotiation. You know, you got to deal with the bringing things in, importing things in through customs, things that we don't usually do. I remember there was one artwork that we were going to borrow from the Moderna Museet, and it was quite large. And it turned out that it was too large for its crate to go on a normal airplane, and therefore it would have had to be taken first, I think, to somewhere in Germany. And it made a huge difference, so we ended up sadly cutting that out of the exhibit.
The current exhibit, as you mentioned, is it drawings by Arthur Bowen Davies? Is that?
Well, it's mostly drawings, but there are paintings as well. It's actually two exhibits at the same time, but they're both Arthur Bowen Davies. Okay. And they were organized by the Meyer Museum, as I mentioned earlier. And the co-curator was Mac Cosgrove Davies, who is the grandson of the artist. Oh. And who sort of serves as a curator and cataloger of an extensive collection of his own and some of his relatives. And many of the works are from the Meyer Museum, but also many of them are from Mac and his family's collections.
Tell us just a little bit briefly about Davies himself.
Yeah, he's a fascinating artist. He's crucial to our collection because he is one of the eight. These were these eight artists who banded together and sort of in the face of the National Academy put together an exhibit at the Macbeth Galleries in 1908. And Davies was one of them. The interesting thing about Davies, you know, the eight were the start of the Ashcan School, one of the important sort of modern American schools. And Davies' own work has this kind of dreamy quality to it. It's like Arcadian images. He was a fantastic draftsman. But you don't necessarily think of what his artwork looks like. He's lumped together as part of the eight and their kind of modernist, you know, approach. But he also was the primary instigator of the famous Armory Show.
Oh, yeah.
Which brought European modernism to America. That was in 1913. And so he's remembered for that. And people sort of, oh, but his art doesn't really look like, you know, Picasso or Picabia or, you know, these artists who are great modernists who are sort of exploding the way art looks. So this is a wonderful chance to show, you know, he has his own kind of modernistic ideals, but his vision is not necessarily like what other modernists did. And it's just a wonderful artist. We have two works by him in our collection.
And is this exhibit, I mean, it's available online, right? People can look at it.
It is, yeah. We've really gone out as much as possible to make it accessible. There is a video walkthrough tour, so you Great. Can see every work, including the two from our collection that we've supplemented the exhibit with. There is a PDF of the catalog that the Meyer Museum put together, so you can read the whole catalog. There is also a PDF of an article that I wrote about the exhibit for the American Art Review that just came out.
Oh, terrific.
And then we, Mac Cosgrove Davies, very generously, he was going to come and give a lecture. And so he and I worked together and we've recorded through Google Meet an online lecture, and that's going to be available. That is available through the website as well.
That's all terrific. The excuse me, the exhibit's coming up. Why don't you tease us a little bit? Give us a sneak preview of at least a few. What's in store?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to do so. The next exhibit, which opens in early February, is an exhibit of the fabric art and poetry of Gwen Westerman. And Gwen is a Dakota scholar and artist and poet. She's been associated with the museum in the past. In 2012, we did an exhibit called Hena Mpiksuyapi, which is Dakota for "We Remember Those." And it was a commemoration of the 38 men who were executed by the U.S. in 1862, the day after Christmas, as part of the aftermath of the Dakota-U.S. War. And I asked Gwen to sort of serve as a co-curator for that exhibit, which invited Native artists, mostly Dakota, to create or show works that somehow commented on that crucial happening of all these people being executed.
That's fantastic.
So Gwen is coming back to do an exhibit of her her quilts and her fabric art and her poetry. She recently was part of an exhibit at the Minneapolis Institute of Art. And so we're very excited to show the works by Gwen. So that's coming up next. And then we'll have our senior show in May.
Right.
Next year, there are a couple different things I want to mention. One is that we will regularly do exhibits of works by the Gustavus Studio Art faculty. And so we're planning an exhibit of Chris Lowe's works in late fall of this year. Opens just before Thanksgiving and will close at the end of J term. And then we also have something that's come up relatively recently. Fevzi Yazici is a Turkish artist. He's a Turkish journalist and artist who has been imprisoned by the government. And he's done a number of artworks from prison. And so this is an exhibit that was organized by St. John's University in Jamaica, New York. And it's going to come here at the at spring of next year.
I just read about him and his art somewhere. I don't know if it was in New York somewhere. That's fantastic. Wow.
Yeah, it's very exciting. There was some major coverage of it in the Washington Post.
Oh, that's where I read it. I read it.
Okay. Yeah.
So and
the interesting thing is he's a journalist, quote unquote, but he's really an art designer for journalism. And his drawings are, they're small because you can't do very large works in prison. And they're very precise. And, just even if you didn't know that fascinating and really compelling story, the works are compelling in and of themselves just for what they are.
That's so great. I look forward to all of those. Great stuff coming up. And, the other thing I wanted to mention, I forgot, but it just occurred to me that, you have, I think as part of the museum's collection, the cartoonist whose cartoons.
Yes.
Yeah.
Gene Bassett.
Yeah. But Gene Bassett, who I remember growing up with some of those, but incredible drawings. Are they editorial cartoons? Is that the right?
Yeah. We did an exhibit in 2005. Those aren't actually in our collection, but Gene is a part of our museum advisory committee, as is his wife, Anne, wonderful people. And, Gene was sent to Vietnam in the mid-60s by the newspapers for which he worked, the Scripps Howard papers. And they basically were hoping to convince him. He's a editorial cartoonist who was doing anti-Vietnam involvement cartoons and drawings. They wanted to convince him that it was a good thing for the U.S. to be there. So he goes off to Vietnam, gets shot at, does a number of images, both of conflict and also sort of daily life. And so we did an exhibit of those drawings, and it was eventually put together as a book as well.
Yes.
And I remember and wanted to thank you again because you did a wonderful gallery talk.
Oh, I was thrilled.
About the Vietnam conflict.
And thrilled.
That was just a fantastic addition to the exhibit. And there was also, I don't know if you call this, but we had at the same time an exhibit by an artist named Long Nguyen.
Yes, I remember.
A California artist who was born in Vietnam and was one of the, I think he was on the last transport out of Vietnam.
Yes.
And those were nice counterpoints to each other.
Yes, I'm literally getting the chills here thinking about all of that. They were great. It was fantastic. And the cartoons, the drawings, especially, you know, sort of just daily life were just absolutely amazing for both soldiers and civilians. Incredible.
Yeah, I mean, just capture so well the movement, the you know, ultimate of any one particular person. For a while, he was actually contributing his drawings to the Free Press in Mankato.
That's just a
great thing.
That's great. Yeah, no, this is just wonderful. That was one of the highlights for me of my time at Gustavus. So lots of things to look forward to, including seeing now the current exhibition. I'm wondering too about Paul Granlund, and we should say something about Paul's work. It's so important, I think, to the identity of Gustavus, and at least its modern identity, current identity. Tell us a little bit about Paul and why his work is significant.
Well, Paul was a Gustavus grad, and then he went on to do graduate studies at the U and also at Cranbrook, and you know, had quite a career, not just at Gustavus, but he kind of, you know, visually symbolizes Gustavus in many ways.
Yes.
And, you know, a master craftsperson in bronze casting. And the college as a whole is sort of a museum to Paul Granlund's work. I don't know how many works there are on public view here on campus. And we have several smaller works, mostly from Reverend Hillstrom, that are part of our collection. You know, just a wonderful man, very inventive. Will Freert wrote a book about Paul's work, and I think that's a very good resource, very appreciative of what kinds of things Paul was doing. And he was very supportive of the museum as well. We did actually two exhibits connected with the sesquicentennial. We did our second major Granlund exhibit, which was of his portraiture, you know, an important part of his whole overall oeuvre. But in 2003, we did a large retrospective show. And that's in the couple of years leading up to that, I worked with Paul very closely and got to know him quite well and considered him a close friend. That exhibit actually opened to the public on the day he died.
Oh, wow. I did not know that. Oh, so that's weird. Right?
Yeah, it was shocking in a way, but I'm so grateful that he got to see it almost in its, you know, final state.
Right.
We're always doing things at the last minute because, you know, small staff.
Sure.
But it was, you know, looking pretty much like it would look, and you did get a chance to see it.
Oh, that's great. That's sad and yet somehow fitting, right, that it opens.
Yeah.
Exactly. I got to see him teach. I can't even remember why, but at some point I was able to watch him teach a class at Gustavus, which was just a wonder. I mean, it was just incredible to watch, both watch him and watch his interaction with the students and watch them watching him too. It was great. I still have vivid memories of that.
And it was always an event when he was casting. People would come and watch it.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'd never watched, but I knew about the events. Yeah. Because that occurred on campus, right? I mean.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he had the foundry right there. And he invited us to bring our kids one Saturday and let them work with some clay. And then he cast those little things that they made in bronze for them.
Oh, that's great. Sweet. Well, we're winding down here, and I want to come to sort of where I ended in the introduction, which is it seems to me that, well, let's put it this way. If I were in charge, and I'm clearly not, right, we, the country, the government, the national government, we would be just, you know, pouring funding into the arts. I mean, theater, music, you name it. We're not. I think they're essential always, but maybe even more essential now. What's your just in general, what's your case for art and art history? Why care about it? Why go to an art museum? Why go to the Hill Street?
Well, a couple things. One is my own experience is that an artwork can really just stop you dead in your tracks and be an incredibly formative experience. I know I've had opportunities to look at works that have just been amazing to me. I think that art has the power to inspire and to console and to enrich people. And when you make art, you as the artist can do that. You can console, you can inspire, you can enrich. And then when you study art, that allows us into that benefit and allows us to understand the communicative aspect of art. I don't think that we're really human without art and the arts.
Exactly.
I think that the impetus to create beauty is maybe not hardwired into people, but it's certainly present. If you look back in any sort of past society, you'll find it.
Right. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think when I think about it, it reflects, maybe it as you say, we have to do art as human beings, and it also, I think, just humanizes us for all the reasons you mentioned. Go ahead.
I was just saying, there's a great quote from Kurt Vonnegut. He says about the arts in general that they're a very human way of making life more bearable. Practicing an art is a way to make your soul grow.
Oh, that's beautiful.
I like that very much.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that's all true. I'm so grateful to my art history teachers when I was an undergraduate at Northern Illinois University. I can picture them both, and in one case, smell the cologne of the other. But Miss Merritt, and she had her hair in a bun, and I was just enthralled listening to her, and of course the slides. And then Mr. Liakos, I'm Greek American. He was from Greece and was always in a really nice suit and reeking of this strong cologne. But oh my God, brilliant! And I'm so grateful for. I probably took them as gen ed courses, right? I'm sure, but I'm so grateful. And when you said the Armory Show, well, that's what it's one of the things I learned from Miss Merritt about the Armory Show. And I'm grateful to you too, Don, for all that you're doing and your staff for Gustavus and for the Hillstrom. It's made Gustavus an even more special place to have the Hillstrom there. I'm sure you feel the same way. If only it could be even bigger, maybe one day, not as a result of a tornado. Yeah. Need that again. The 98 tornado. Yeah. But, best of luck with everything. Look forward to seeing, not only the Davies, but what's forthcoming, and urge listeners to do the same. So thank you so much. Really appreciate this. Take good care.
Thank you, Greg.
You're quite welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing. Gustavus graduate Will Clark, class of 20, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College.